Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of New Books in German Studies. We are part of the New Books Network of Podcasts. My name is Michael O'Sullivan of Marist College. I'm one of the many co-hosts of this channel. Today, we are very lucky to have with us Larry Eugene Jones, and we're going to be discussing his book, Hitler versus Hindenburg, the 1932 presidential election and the end of the Weimar Republic, published with Cambridge University Press in 2016. Professor Jones has been a professor at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York, and he's also an internationally recognized expert in the political history of the Weimar Republic. He also happens to have been one of my own personal mentors as I was an undergraduate at Canisius College before I got my own career started. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the show.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So, Larry, I just wanted to start out today with sort of our usual traditional start to New Books in German Studies, and I just wanted to know if you could tell us a little bit about how you became interested in the politics of the Weimar Republic.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think my interest in the Weimar Republic goes back to, you have to remember that I was a product of the 1960s. I graduated from the University of Kansas in 1961 and then was at the University of Wisconsin from 63 to 66. And those were very heady days, I think, for young people like myself. And I think at that time I began to ask myself the question of whether or not what had happened in Germany might happen in the United States as well. You remember those? That was the days of the Vietnam protest, and I think that the American system stood on the brink of something, and I was very concerned that what happened in Germany might replicate itself here in the United States, and I think that was clearly what pushed my inquiry, my interest in that direction.
That's interesting. There might be some people who feel the same way about our current political moment.
Yeah, I think my original conclusion was that the political cultures of the United States and Germany were so different that what had happened in Germany could not reproduce itself here in the United States. But I would agree with you now. Maybe I'm rethinking that question.
All right. And I was wondering, because you have such a long and distinguished career of publishing about the politics of the Weimar Republic, if you'd be willing to just talk a little bit about, concisely some of your previous work on Weimar politics.
Well, my first interest in this respect was the failure of German liberalism and why it had to do also with the failure of Weimar democracy. And my dissertation at the University of Wisconsin dealt with the failure of the liberals to coalesce into a single political party that might have been more resistant to the rise of national socialism and that might have provided, I think, a better bulwark of support for the Weimar Republic. And since then, my interest has shifted more from the liberal middle or the liberal parties to the German right. And I think I sort of concluded my work on the German liberal parties in the late 1980s with the publication of a book at the University of North Carolina Press entitled German Liberalism and the Dissolution of the Weimar Party System. But at the same time I'd been finishing that book, I'd begun collecting materials and doing research on not just the right-wing political parties, but right-wing interest groups and right-wing patriotic associations. And I had expected to turn something out fairly quickly after the publication of my first book, but that I was deluding myself there. And then suddenly at the very end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s, all of the materials that were in the former German Democratic Republic were suddenly made available. And there was an enormous amount of material in the former Deutsche Zentralarchiv that I would not have had access to otherwise that became available. And so the scope of my work, a project there greatly expanded and took a lot more time than I had originally imagined. So I had been working on that general topic since the 1990s, I was not making as much progress or as quick a progress as I had hoped. And I was talking to my editor at Cambridge University Press. His name is Lewis Bateman. And I sort of expressed my frustration. He says, well, why don't you take a break from that and do something a little more specific? And at that time, I was talking to him about where I was in the project. I was really up to the 1932 presidential elections, where Hindenburg and Hitler confronted each other for the vice presidency. I mentioned to him how difficult it was to work through that period because so little had been done, particularly on the elections. And he says, well, why don't you take time off from the larger project and write a book on the 1932 elections? And so the book that we're discussing today is the product of that sort of thinking.
Great. So that's a nice segue into starting to talk about the book itself. So I appreciate that. And I'd like to start, I guess, in principle with some things you write about in the introduction, but that also leads us into a discussion of the broader, your broader conception of the book, right? And since you're, you know, one of the most widely published, not just in your books, but in your edited volumes and your journal articles, you're one of the most widely published historians of politics. I was wondering if you'd start by giving us something of a reflection on political history, the state of political history. And one thing that interests me a little bit that you discuss in the introduction of the book is this tension in political history between the agency of the individual political actor or the individual politician versus some of the constraints that that individual faces in comparison to social institutions, cultural norms, and so on.
That's a good question. And again, let me provide some personal biography here. I mean, I had the remarkably good fortune to study in Germany with two of the preeminent historians of this period. First, Karl Dietrich Brocker. I had a Fulbright at the University of Bonn from 66 to 68. And then I later had a two-year Humboldt fellowship at the University of Bochum, where I worked with Hans Mommsen. And I think that they were both what I would consider certainly political historians, although Brocker himself was a political scientist, but he wrote history. And they were interested first and foremost in trying to understand the structural factors that conditioned or framed the conduct of politics. And while both of them would place a great deal of emphasis upon the long-range structural factors that shaped the course of German history and German politics, they also believed, and this comes out very explicitly in their work, that the actions of individual historical actors were ultimately what sort of defined the direction that these long-range historical factors, culture, economics, social structure, would go. I think there is a, if I'm trying to remember this directly, I think there's a passage in Max Weber in one of his lectures on the sociology of religion, where he says that it's material interests that drive the process of historical change, but it is the action of individuals. Individuals act as switchmen to determine which course these long-range historical factors will move in. And that has always sort of been a guiding metaphor for my own work. While it is primarily important to understand the structures, here we're talking about the economic structures, the institutional structures of a given society that limit the opportunity for individual action. Still, it is action that will determine in certain critical states, not necessarily at all times, but there are certain crises that develop where the opportunities for individual historic agency are much greater than they might have been at other points in the process. I hope I made that sufficiently clear.
Yeah, absolutely. And just then looking at another issue from the introduction, obviously introductions are frequently where you discuss sort of the broader impact of the book. And it seemed to me at least that one of the major theses you would advance in the book are, first of all, that this election was very important to the non-Nazi right. And second of all, that this election tells us something about the fragmentation of the non-Nazi right.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there's a recent argument that has been advanced in a book by Daniel Z. Blatt from Harvard. I think it's called Conservative Parties and Democracy. The central thesis of his argument is that the transition from an authoritarian system of government to democracy occurs most easily in those political cultures where there is a strong state-supporting conservative party that is loyal to the existing system of government. And the question then becomes is, why did such a party never develop in Germany? In contrast to the Tory party in Great Britain, which had became a bulwark of British democracy. And the short answer to that question is that the forces on the German right were so badly fragmented that they could not coalesce into a particular party that might have provided the Weimar Republic with the sort of stability it needed. Now, in this respect, the elections in 1932 are a critical event in the sense that by that time, the most important of Germany's right-wing parties, the German National People's Party, or DNVP as we sometimes refer to it, had already suffered two major successions in 1920, at the end of 1929, and then again in the summer of 1930. The party at that time was in the hands of the most radical elements within the party who were opposed to any sort of accommodation with the Weimar system and that were at that time interested in developing closer ties to the emerging Nazi party. The leader of the DNVP was a man by the name of Alfred Hugenberg, and he was, I think, best described as sort of an irascible opponent of Weimar democracy and was determined to do everything he could to destroy the system of government that had been established back in 1918-1919. The 1932 elections offered an opportunity for the right to sort of reunite or to coalesce behind the candidacy of Hindenburg. Hindenburg had been elected to his first term as Reichspräsident in November in 1925. And at that time, virtually the entire right, with the exception of the extreme right wing, had coalesced behind his candidacy and had catapulted him to the presidency. The question now was whether or not that would happen again in 7 years later when his term expired and when new elections were to be held. He was a reluctant candidate. At that time, he was well into his 80s. He thought he had served his nation well and deserved, to spend the last years of his life in relative comfort. The situation in Germany was such that people on the more moderate right, including some in the military, prevailed upon him to stand for re-election. And the hope was that all but the most extreme elements on the right would coalesce behind his candidacy. And I think the election took on added significance when Adolf Hitler declared shortly after Hindenburg himself had announced his candidacy, Hitler declared that he was going to oppose Hindenburg for the presidency. So here you have the two dominant figures on the German right, Hindenburg, who represents the more traditional and authentically conservative elements of the German right. And on the other hand, you have Adolf Hitler, who represents the new right and the more fascist right, if I can use that term to describe the Nazi Party.
And Larry, I wonder if just for the for our audience, before we go any further, it might be useful then to maybe just finish your sketch of who the major players are on the non-Nazi right versus the Nazi right. And then I think related to the presidential election, just describing the, for anyone who might not know, the function of the presidency and how the presidential election worked in the Weimar system.
Well, let me answer the first question. Okay. The Reich presidency was actually created in large part in response to Max Weber's arguments, what he wanted to do. Weber was very concerned in the deliberations about the Weimar Constitution that he did not want to put all of the power in the parliament, because he felt that there had to be some sort of check on the upon a popularly elected parliament where that would be subject to short-term fluctuations in public opinion and all of the vicissitudes of party politics and all of that. And he thought that the best guarantee against the domination of the masses with all of that, what all of that was supposed to mean, would be to have a strong popularly elected president who would serve a term sufficiently long that he would be able to ride these momentary changes in public opinion and in political popularity. So it was a check on that. And the president was invested with important powers. Foremost among his powers was the power to appoint the chancellor. And the chancellors from 1919 to 1933 were all appointed through the constitutional process by the president. The other thing that I would say about this is that the Constitution also invested the president with certain emergency powers under the terms of Article 48. And he could use these emergency powers to introduce legislation on the strength of his own authority without necessarily having to subject that to the Reichstag for parliamentary approval. These sort of powers were only to be employed in emergencies and only to be employed when it proved difficult for one reason or another to get the approval of the Reichstag. These powers had been evoked in 1923 at the height of the hyperinflation of the early Weimar Republic. And at that time, the chancellor, his name was Wilhelm March from the Center Party. He did use presidential emergency powers to stabilize the mark and to undertake other economic and financial reforms that he could never have gotten through the Reichstag. Now, in 1930, in the early stages of the world economic crisis, Hindenburg had to, Hindenburg again, had to resort to the sort of, I have to correct that. Hindenburg had not been the one who did it in 1923. That had been Ebert. But now Hindenburg makes use of these powers again. And he does it through one of the key players in the events of 1933, 30 to 33, and that is Heinrich Brüning. Heinrich Brüning was the chancellor who was installed in office in March of 1930 and given the task of restoring a measure of fiscal and economic sanity to Germany. He was particularly interested in doing what he could to balance the budget in the face of mounting expenditures, large part for unemployment insurance. And Bruning realized from the beginning that it would be extremely difficult for him to secure approval through the Reichstag, through the German parliament, and consequently Hindenburg vested him or gave him these special emergency powers that Article 48 of the Constitution authorized. And I think in general, Bruning was, while he was prepared to use these powers, he would prefer to have introduced his sort of his fiscal program through the Reichstag with the support of a parliamentary majority there. But it became quite clear, in large part because of the entrenchments of the German right, the German National People's Party, that he could not get a parliamentary majority to do this. And so he, in April of 1930, resorted to the use of Article 48 to do this. The other key players in the events that we're talking about, Bruning is certainly a key player. He is the one who actually goes to Hindenburg and prevails upon Hindenburg to stand for re-election in 1932. At that time, the relationship between Hindenburg and Bruning was fairly good. There had been some strain in the summer of 1931 because Bruning did not move quickly enough or aggressively enough towards an alliance with the German right. But the relationship was still in fairly good shape in the spring of 1932. The other key player here is the sort of political strategist, chief political strategist in the Reichswehr or in the German army, a man by the name of Kurt von Schleicher. And Schleicher had a somewhat different approach to the political situation that Germany found itself in 32. He was very cautious, very wary of what was going on the extreme right. He had followed Hitler's political career from the early 1920s. I can't exactly remember how he described him, but he certainly thought that that Hitler was incompetent to assume any role of political responsibility. He says at one time that he is a demagogue without any sense of what the real situation is like. He said that very early in looking at Hitler in the early 1920s. And he was alarmed at the fact that in the most recent national elections, the Nazi Party had achieved an astonishing electoral breakthrough, that it had received 107 seats in parliament, that it had gotten about 14% of the popular vote. And he also realized that with the deteriorating economic situation in Germany, the appeal of National Socialism seemed to be growing every day. And that was certainly reflected in a series of state and provincial elections that had been held in 1929, 1930, you could document the growing strength of the party. And in trying to figure out how to deal with the threat of National Socialism, Schleicher came up with what is called the taming strategy. The taming strategy argued that the best way of dealing with the Nazi threat was to bring the Nazi Party into the government and saddle them with governmental responsibility. And that in turn would force them to act responsibly. It would deprive them of the advantage they enjoyed as an opposition party that could attack the government with impunity. You give them a share of responsibility, and again, they would behave more responsibly. That was his strategy. It was a strategy that found support in other sectors of the non-Nazi right. And it also enjoyed the support of influential figures within the German business community, within German industry in particular. And it was basically a question of when do you begin to deploy this strategy. Schleicher had tried to push Bruning in that direction in August of 1931, but Bruning resisted in large part because he had no confidence in Hitler. and he had no confidence, certainly, in Hugenberg as leader of the DNVP. Other key players in the events that we're talking about, I think here is the dynamic that develops. Hugenberg is adamantly opposed to anything that might help Bruning stabilize his position in as chancellor. And so Alfred Hugenberg, again, the leader of the DNVP, the nominally conservative political party that had moved radically to the right between 1928 and 1932, Hugenberg adamantly opposed Hindenburg's candidacy in large part because he saw that as a shield for Bruning. He probably would have supported Hugenberg if Hugenberg had disavowed Bruning, had disassociated himself from Bruning altogether. But as long as Bruning remained as chancellor, Hugenberg would continue to do everything in his power to defeat Hindenburg as president. Now, the question was, once Hindenburg had declared his candidacy, once it became clear that Hitler himself would emerge as a candidate, who would Hugenberg himself run? He toyed with the idea, but he was eventually dissuaded from doing that, with the result that Hugenberg and his cadre, cohort of supporters, decided instead to nominate another person, a man by the name of Theodor Dusterberg, who was head of a large conservative veterans organization known as the Stahlhelm or Steel Helmet. And so what we have here are three basic major candidates for the presidency, all on the German right, okay? Hindenburg, Hitler, and Dusterberg. Now, there is one other candidate of significance. This is a man by the name of Ernst Thälmann, who is the candidate of the Communist Party, but he does not figure very prominently in the calculations of the German right. The question then becomes, who are the people who had opposed Hindenburg in 1925, who had rallied behind the campaign of Wilhelm Marx in what was an unsuccessful attempt to keep Hindenburg from becoming president? Who were they going to vote for? And they weighed the possibility of running a candidate of their own, but realized that that would be a hopeless proposition given the political circumstances that existed in early 32. And one by one, first the German Center Party, which was the party of German Catholics, the Bavarian People's Party, which was the party of the Catholics in Bavaria, German Liberal Parties, there were two of significance, the German State Party and the German Democratic Party. And then most importantly, there was the Social Democratic Party, the party of the German working class, the most visible party on the German left. What would they do? And one by one, they all threw their support behind Hindenburg's candidacy. So what you have in 1932 is a reversal of the electoral coalitions that had existed in 1925. In 1925, Hindenburg had enjoyed the support of the German right and even some of the non-socialist parties in the German middle. Social Democrats and the Center Party and even the German Democratic Party had supported the candidacy of Hindenburg's opponent, Wilhelm Marx. Now, in 1932, you have a total reversal of that, where the Democratic parties, the Social Democrats, the Liberal parties, etc., rally behind Hindenburg, okay? And the right-wing elements that had supported Hindenburg in 25 now are forced to choose between Duesterberg or Hitler. And in that choice, most of them seem to be moving towards Hitler rather than towards Hugenberg's candidate. That would be Duesterberg. So it's a sort of a very complicated political constellation that emerges in the spring of 1932. But the remarkable thing is that there's this sort of reversal of coalitions.
And one thing that really interested me about the book was that how you describe it is Hindenburg often didn't feel like he should campaign or didn't campaign much. And you seem to have this dynamic that Heinrich Brüning it was his job to get Hindenburg reelected.
That was it. I mean, that was part of the agreement, the contract. Hindenburg never ventured from his estate in Neudeck. When he was not in Berlin, he was on his estate. He received a couple of delegations there. He issued a couple of statements. He really only made one speech during the entire campaign. It was Brüning who did most of the campaigning for Hindenburg. That's somewhat unusual, but that Hindenburg did not play a more active role in his own campaign. But he put everything on Brüning's shoulders in that regard.
And then, in some ways, Brüning becomes something of a tragic figure in that he then, in some ways, carries the blame in Hindenburg's eyes for the fact that he gets reelected by voters that he doesn't necessarily feel terribly connected to. That this flip that you described was a frustrating thing for Hindenburg to cope with.
It may have been, I don't know whether it was frustrating for Hindenburg or not. It was probably going to be more frustrating for Brüning because almost immediately after the election, Brüning had an audience with Hindenburg in which Hindenburg simply told him, now it's time to carry out a realignment of your government and move to the right. Mm-hmm. Issued that in sort of in the form of an ultimatum. And Brüning resisted. He says, you can't treat the Social Democrats that way. These are people who put their reputation on the line for you. He's talking specifically about the Social Democratic Minister President of Prussia, Otto Braun, who also weighed in very heavily in getting the Social Democratic Party in line. And Brüning's position is that you can't treat these people. It would be an act of betrayal of their trust if you did. And so Hindenburg backed off. But in any event, Brüning was under immense pressure, to bring the elements on the German right into his cabinet. But those elements were absolutely, opposed to becoming part of any cabinet that was headed by Brüning. And so they were advocating for a more radical reorganization of the government. There were different schemes. Maybe Brüning would stay on as chancellor, but he would not be the one who would be pulling the strings, so to speak. Or maybe they would continue him in the capacity of foreign minister. You have from, say, the elections, the final second round of the elections was on April 10th. So between April 10th through May and into June, you have this real stalemate that develops. And I think the key figure here at this point is Schleicher, who has a good deal of influence with Hindenburg because he represents the German military, and he is doing his best to, I wouldn't say, sort of maneuver Brüning out of power. And I'm not going to go, I wouldn't, don't want to go through all of the details of that, but all of this does draw to a climax when between May 28th and May 30th, 1932, Brüning is forced to resign. He loses Hindenburg's confidence. and Isri obliged to step down as chancellor in his famous slogan, 100 meters before the end, because he was at that time involved in negotiations aimed at bringing an end to reparations. Had he done that, I think his popularity would have been greatly enhanced and it may have been more difficult to move him out of the office. And so there were pressures, particularly from the military, to force his removal from office before he could claim credit for ending Germany's reparations burden.
Now, just shifting gears a little bit, just because it seems like a topic that's very important to the book, you spend a fair amount of time talking about this Herzberg rally and this so-called Herzberg Front.
Yes.
And I just wondered if you could talk about that in the context of your larger thesis about fragmentation here.
Well, the Herzberg Front refers to a rally in the resort town of Bad Harzburg in the second week of October 1931. This was the brainchild of Hugenberg. He wanted to bring all of the elements on the German right, including the Nazis, together for a demonstration against the Bruning cabinet, hopefully from Hugenberg's position, hopefully in putting pressure upon Hindenburg to bring about a change of governments. That was the goal, and this was timed to coincide with the reopening of the German Reichstag, when Bruning himself would have to present another one of these draconian emergency decrees on fiscal and economic policy to the Reichstag. Question of whether or not he would survive a vote in the Reichstag, and the Herzberg rally was designed to position the German right to assume power if, in fact, Bruning failed. The Herzberg rally, however, turned out to be a major fiasco, in large part because of the antics of Hitler himself. Hitler did not want to be sort of harnessed to the agenda of the more traditional and conservative elements on the German right. Hitler conceived of himself as a revolutionary nationalist and really had very little sympathy, very little interest, very little respect for traditional German conservatives who were allied to conservative elites in agriculture and industry and all of that. And so Hitler was very wary of being trapped in this respect. And the other irony is that here is that right before the Herzberg rally, Hitler had a meeting with Schleicher in Berlin. And Schleicher had, I think I would put it this way, greatly sort of inflated Hitler's own sense of destiny, so to speak. Whether or not Schleicher was trying to sabotage the Herzberg Front, that is very likely. And he may have been playing Hitler in order to get Hitler to do his dirty work for him. But in any event, when Hitler went to Herzberg, he went with the idea of keeping as much distance between himself, Nazi Party on one hand, and the conservatives around Hugenberg and the Stahlhelm on the other. And so when the Steel Helmet or the Stahlhelm marched in this parade through the city of Herzberg and all of that, Hitler left the podium. He didn't stay on the podium when they installed him. It was a sign of his own disdain, as something that was taken as an insult. There were other things that went on where Hitler simply made it quite clear that he had no intention of cooperating with these, that he would show up for demonstrations by his own party and by its formations. But when other elements of this sort of national front were involved, he would absent himself so. In any event, the Herzberg Front failed miserably because instead of affirming the unity of the German right, it displayed just how deep the divide between the more traditional elements on the right and the more radical elements on the right was.
Great. And that, taking our next step, I'd like to transition to a concept that you talk about throughout the book, and it really struck me especially in reading the conclusion of the book, where you talk about the problems of this election in both candidates is that both the legitimacy of the Hindenburg and the Hitler candidacy both rested to a certain degree on charisma, and charisma over what I would say rational argument. I can't remember the term you use in the book.
Okay.
But could you talk a little bit about what you meant by that and why that was so problematic for the survival of Weimar democracy?
Well, I think it's going on here. I think it's important to point out that both Hitler and Hindenburg relied very heavily upon charisma as a way of legitimating their claim to the leadership of the German nation. This has always been very evident in the case of Hitler. There have been, from the very beginning, political sociologists, journalists have all drawn attention to Hitler's charisma. So that's not a particularly new idea. But it also seems, it also, you know, on the certainly that Hindenburg also relied very heavily on charisma. And this is the point of a book that Wolfram Puta, a German historian who teaches at the University of Tübingen, has made in his recent biography of Hindenburg. And that Hindenburg, from the very beginning, well, I'm going to put it this way. One of Hindenburg's closest aides, Wilhelm Gruner, who served as the Minister of Defense in Germany from 1928 to 1932, said that out of the collapse of 1918, out of the shambles of the German military at the end of World War I, something had to be preserved to serve as a symbol around which the nation could unite, and that was Hindenburg. So from the very beginning, from 1919, 1920, there is an attempt to create or to give Hindenburg a sort of mythic stature. The term Hindenburg myth was used at the time. It has been certainly used in subsequent studies of Hindenburg. And so he was invested with this sort of mythic, almost superhuman quality. And so what we find in 1932 is that you have two different claims to leadership, one by Hindenburg, one by Hitler, and both of them legitimate their claims through some sort of charismatic appeal. Now, the charisma is different in the sense that I think Hindenburg's charisma is more rooted in the traditions of German greatness and specifically what they call the Prussian tradition, whereas in Hitler's case, his charisma is much more revolutionary in nature and draws from an entirely different sort of, I think, psychological resource. So what we have is, two different players here, competing against each other through a sort of charismatic appeal that they exercise over the German public. Now, the net effect of this is that the election, although it ends, and this is something we have to read it, in Hindenburg's victory over Hitler, which would have been a major victory for the forces of Weimar democracy. I'm not certain that's exactly how it was, but that was how it was read at the time. And that despite that, the net effect of the election and the net effect of the way in which charisma was deployed in the election was to undermine the whole pattern of legitimation upon which the Weimar Republic itself was based. The Weimar Republic functioned by this time as an instrument for the mediation of conflicts between different sectors, different interest groups in German society. And that's how politics had defined itself. Politics was conceived of as the medium through which different economic interest groups in German society advance their own agenda and their own interests. To be sure, by 1929, 1930, it was impossible to do that because these interests there was such a confrontation between these different interests that it had a paralytic effect, paralyzed, the democratic process itself. So you already have the blockage of these interests and their inability to achieve much because of the conflicts so you have the complete, and all of that is greatly exacerbated by the deepening economic crisis through the early 1930s. So in any event, the more traditional conception of politics based upon the representation of interest through parliament and through parties, that is already, I think, coming under fire. It's already becoming increasingly dysfunctional. So there is a sort of a crisis situation in 1932 where I think more and more German people tend to look for someone who, there's a very strong messianic impulse at work within German political culture then. It seems that there is the longing for the savior who will rescue Germany from the morass of party politics, okay, and restore the health and sanity of the German nation. And so in many respects, both Hindenburg and Hitler feed that impulse by portraying themselves as the Messiah or as the savior of the German nation. And this becomes an increasingly powerful impulse in the last months of the Weimar Republic, and it makes it virtually impossible to somehow restore parliamentary government as it had functioned up to the great crisis of 1929-1930.
In some ways, I think this leads then to sort of how you end the book, right? Where Hindenburg won re-election, but yes. Hitler in many ways was the real victor of 1932 in the long run.
Well, he was. And I mean, there was certainly some despondence in the Nazi camp immediately after Hindenburg's victory. I mean, at that time, you didn't have the type of polling that you have here today. And so I think the Nazis really thought in March, April of 32 that they were going to win that runoff election. But they didn't, and Hitler, who was a very moody and emotional person, was immediately despondent but it was Goebbels who really turned him around. Joseph Goebbels was his propaganda minister and head of the propaganda organization within the Nazi party. Works on him right away, sudden change of mood, and they realize that, well, this is only one setback, but the ultimate victory is ours, and they immediately begin to intensify pressure upon the government for change of cabinets and for Hitler bringing the Nazis into the government. And so Hitler, I think, is the ultimate victor in large part because the people who are running the political system at this time, and that would include Schleicher and certainly, I think, Hindenburg's Secretary of State, Otto Meissner, people like this realize that you cannot govern without having the Nazis in the government, and it becomes a question of whether or not you work out some sort of arrangement by which the Nazis enter the government or take control of the government. Those are the two options that seem to exist at that point in time. And there are certainly some ups and downs between April of 32 and January of 33, where it doesn't always seem that that's going to happen or work out in that particular way. But in many respects, Hitler's defeat does little to diminish the legitimacy of the claims that he is making upon the loyalties of the German people. And then I think just sort of wrap this up. What we have in January of 1933, when Hindenburg, under increasing pressure from various sectors of conservative elites, appoints Hitler as chancellor on January 30th, 1933. And then we have this situation, I think, where we see, and this is the argument that Puthe makes towards the end of his book, is that we have a new regime that is founded on the sort of combined charisma of Hindenburg on one hand and Hitler on the other. That provides the sort of charismatic legitimation of the Third Reich that certainly carries Hitler through those first turbulent 6 months of the regime.
All right. Well, I would say that we've taken up a lot of your time at this point, so I'd like to conclude with our usual final question at the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now? What are your current projects?
Well, I'm going back to finish the project that I was working on when I was advised to take a break from it and to write the book on 32 elections. So I am completing the final stages of a manuscript that is tentatively entitled The German Reich, 1918-1930, Political Parties, Organized Interest, and Patriotic Associations in the Struggle Against Weimar Democracy.
Great. Yeah. And I think you also have an edited volume that's about to come out. Is that correct?
I do have an edited volume. I'm co-edited. It's co-edited with Herman Beck, University of Miami, and it is titled From Weimar to Hitler. Subtitle is the Dissolution of Weimar Democracy and the Establishment of the Third Reich, 1932 to 1934. And so it is a book that covers basically what we call the Nazi seizure of power. It begins with the appointment of the Papen cabinet in January 1st, 32, and continues through the Röhm purge in June 30th, 1934.
Great. Well, it sounds like we might need to have you back on the show to talk about one or both of those books down the line.
More than happy to do so.
All right, Larry. Well, thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
And, at this point, I'll sign off and let everyone know that you've been listening to New Books in German Studies. Once again, a podcast that belongs to the New Books Network of Podcasts. My name is Michael O'Sullivan of Marist College, and I'm one of several co-hosts of this channel. We've been talking today with Larry Eugene Jones of Canisius College, and we've been discussing his book, his recent book, Hitler versus Hindenburg, the 1932 presidential election and the end of the Weimar Republic, published with Cambridge University Press in 2016. We hope you'll tune in with us again next time, and I hope you continue listening to our network. Thank you very much.